Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. And welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Russ Yarrow, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, General Manager of Corporate Affairs at Chevron, and your chair for the program. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is another in the California Innovation Series, a partnership between the Commonwealth Club and Chevron to explore solutions to the critical issues facing California. Our focus today is the economic future of California and its status as a bellwether for the rest of the nation when it comes to staying competitive in a flat world. How can California and the U.S. remain economically competitive with the eager, talented, and educated middle classes emerging in China, India, and elsewhere? Natural resources drove California's first economic boom, and information technology fostered the most recent revolution of jobs and growth. What will be next? As the world becomes flat, globalization presents challenges. Will Californians innovate their way out? And what lessons can Californians both teach and learn from the rest of the U.S.? Today, our prominent panel includes a world-renowned economist, a futurist, and innovators in both government and business. They will discuss the issues challenging the current business environment, both in California and America, and provide insight into what must be done to ensure economic success. To begin the panel and to introduce our members, it is now my pleasure to welcome our distinguished moderator, Sydney Kohara, news anchor for CBS 5 Television in San Francisco. Ms. Kohara has covered business and finance around the world. She notably served as CNBC's international financial correspondent based in London, where she provided the latest news and information on Asian and European markets for CNBC's Today's Business, Squawk Box, and MarketWatch. Ms. Kohara also anchored CNBC Asia's flagship news show, Asia Nightly News, based in Singapore and serving more than 20 million viewers in the Asia-Pacific region. Ms. Kohara has been nationally recognized for her work, sharing a prestigious George Foster Peabody Award and the Edward R. Murrow Award for Excellence in Reporting, two of the highest honors in U.S. broadcast journalism. She's active in the Accrediting Council on Education in Journalism and Mass Communications and teaches broadcast communication classes in the Bay Area. I am delighted to turn the program over to Sydney.
Russ, thank you very much. As we begin the discussion, it is my pleasure now to introduce our distinguished panelists. Dr. Laura Tyson is a renowned economist and member of President Obama's Economic Recovery Advisory Board. She also served as the chair of President Clinton's Council on Economic Advisers and has been director of the National Economic Council. Dr. Tyson currently serves as professor and holds the S.K. and Angela Chan Chair in Global Management at the Haas School of Business at the University of California at Berkeley. She has also served as dean of the Haas School as well as dean of the London School of Business. Paul Saffo is a widely regarded economic futurist. He is a forecaster with more than two decades of experience exploring the dynamics of large-scale, long-term change. He is managing director at Discern Analytics and a visiting scholar at the Stanford MediaX Research Network. Mr. Saffo is the founding chairman of the Samsung Science Board and serves on a variety of not-for-profit boards, including the Long Now Foundation and the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. He is also a columnist for abcnews.com, and his essays have appeared in numerous publications, including the Harvard Business Review, Fortune, Wired, and the New York Times. Nancy Fund is a managing partner of DBL Investors, a spinoff of J.P. Morgan. The investment firm focuses on delivering strong financial returns together with positive social, environmental, and economic impact. Ms. Fun joined J.P. Morgan, which was then Hambrick & Quist, in 1984 as a securities analyst and later became managing director in 1989. She currently sponsors or sits on the board of directors of several companies, including Tesla Motors, Pandora, BrightSource Energy, SolarCity, and E-Meter. Ms. Fund is also a member of the board of directors of the California Clean Energy Fund, and most recently, she has been appointed as a member of California Public Utilities Commissioner Timothy Simon's New Directions Program for the Future of California. Robert Hertzberg is the former Speaker of the California State Assembly, a partner with the global law firm of Mayer Brown, LLP, and an environmental entrepreneur. While in government, Mr. Hertzberg focused extensively on issues of globalization. He formed the Speaker's Office in International Relations and remains chairman of the California Assembly International Foundation, which helps to promote understanding between California's legislative leaders and other leaders around the globe. Recently, Mr. Hertzberg was named co-chair of California Forward, a nonpartisan group focused on repairing the dysfunction of California government, which began as a project here at the Commonwealth Club. Mr. Hertzberg also has an extensive involvement with various renewable energy businesses. The UK's Guardian magazine listed Mr. Hertzberg as one of the 50 people who could save the planet. Can't wait to hear from him.
Thank goodness.
Bob Klein is chairman of the governing board of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. As chairman, Mr. Klein manages the peer review and grant process for the $3 billion in stem cell research funding authorized by Proposition 71, an initiative he authored and saw passed by 59% of California voters in 2004. Time magazine honored him as one of the world's 100 most influential people of the year, and he was named one of the Scientific American 50 shaping the future of science. Mr. Klein has also been involved in numerous civic activities, including serving for 6 years as a board member of the California Housing Finance Agency. He is currently president of Klein Financial Corporation, a real estate investment banking consulting company focused on affordable housing finance. We welcome all of our panelists. We have the experts here, and now we are looking for answers. Let's start with a couple of facts, and they certainly aren't encouraging ones. The nation lost a total of 125,000 jobs in June. The national unemployment rate is at 9.5%. California's unemployment rate, 12.4%. The most recent data on housing, manufacturing, and car sales all show weakening activity. So against that background, how can California and the nation keep a competitive edge? Where will we find the answer? Is it innovation, education, government, or a combination? Dr. Tyson, you're sitting next to me. You go first, and welcome.
Well, I'm basically honored to be with such a prestigious group, and I'll just start by the observation that if you think about the three things you said, government, innovation, and education, and said, should it be one or the other, a combination, if you think about innovation and education, government always plays a very important role. Government is, in all advanced industrial countries and in most emerging market countries as well, the major provider of funding for education. And it is the major provider of funding for research and development. It is the major provider of funding for research universities. So I think when you have a government that is ill or sick, I think it actually does endanger the competitiveness of the private economy. At the end of the day, the private economy will take the innovation and take the educated workforce and create business and create profits and create jobs. But the foundations have to be in place. And I think one of the things my other panelists will talk about is whether California, the system, is broken. Because I would argue that California does have, and has had for a long time, some of the basics of being a very competitive place. But we knew, even when the economy was very strong, that California would have an extremely difficult time weathering a very severe downturn because it didn't have a budgetary system that even functioned well in a strong economy. And I'll just end my opening comments by saying we shouldn't forget that we are living through the worst economic and financial crisis in any of our lifetimes. I look around the room and I'm pretty confident saying that. This is an order of magnitude different as a crisis. And the challenge for all of us is, as we handle the crisis, not to undermine investments in things that determine our long-run competitiveness, like investments in education, investments in research, and investments in infrastructure.
Robert Hertzberg, let's go with you. You are from government. Do you agree?
I do. Let me just add, if I could add a little dimension from California point of view here. I don't think that California government is sick or ill. It's just different. We had a society that just...
Is that a good thing?
It is. I mean, look, you know, 100 years ago we made horseshoes. Now we got to make silicon chips and silicon solar cells. The world has changed. Globalization has changed the dynamic. Just a couple of things that are important contextually as we start this discussion. The founders of this country were worried about tyranny. So they created a government that worked slow, that had checks and balances, that separated power, and speed was determined by how fast Thomas Jefferson's pen worked. It was different those days, and now speed to market is everything. Money is moved, trillions of dollars is moved at the push of a button, and so the rules have changed. California's been pretty successful by orders of magnitude. You know, we look at the aerospace industry, we look at high tech in a number of ways, biotech. We've done brilliantly well. The question is, how do we reinvent it now? What worries me in the big picture, as I've traveled the globe working in the renewable space after leaving government in California, is that California's brand has been incredible. The folks, my family coming from Riga, Latvia, and other parts of the world, everybody in this room and the audience listening have stories about their families and where they came from. And they came to California because it's this place of inspiration and innovation and creativity where you could really, in addition to the beauty of the place, really do things at a higher and different level. I would just argue that the rules have changed and that we have to be as innovative in government as we have been in biotech and in high tech and in other areas in figuring out what that new world order looks like and how we can still be a vibrant democracy that's inclusive of all folks, not just Protestant white men who owned land, which was what the framers started out with, but everybody, and still be competitive globally. And I think at the cornerstone, following is from all of it is innovation, government helping innovation, education, fostering innovation, because that creates the high-value jobs. Because I just share this one final point. When I was doing business in Shenzhen, China, people are saying, why are you doing business here? You can go to Vietnam. You're paying $200 an employee. We can get them in Vietnam for $100 an employee. We're not going to avoid that. But what we can do is to create the innovative, high-value jobs that pay for health insurance and all the things that we want for a vibrant democracy.
Bob Klein,
well,
certainly in an innovative field.
Right. So from the innovative perspective, California's 7 million visionary voters who voted in 2004 for $3 billion for stem cell research placed California at the hub of a global network for stem cell research. We now have bilateral funding agreements with seven nations. And being a first mover at the hub of that international network, we advance medical research therapies for chronic disease for patients, and certainly I was motivated as a patient advocate to write the initiative because my son, youngest son, has juvenile diabetes. So both for the world and for California, we are innovating in a form of government with an independent public corporation of the state that has an independent expert board, not a political board, but an expert board determined with very specific criteria that has made a paradigm shift in how you fund science, which is a long-term commitment, long-term financial commitment that's independent of the state budget process, as approved directly by the voters, to have 10 to 15 years of funding so you can attract the best of a generation in this country and on matching funds from other countries from around the world to partner with us to move from chronic disease treatments with chronic therapies to interventionist therapies that cure diseases, that grossly mitigate disease, because if we don't address that subject, if we don't intervene in healthcare, we will bankrupt the state and the nation with healthcare costs. We have a paradigm shift that California has innovated with. It's attracted with the $1 billion of commitments we've made, $1 billion in donor and institutional matching funds. That's a pretty good endorsement from outside parties writing checks. But what's key here is California has the spirit of innovation. We're innovating in government. We're showing that there is a better way to move research forward, where researchers know if they've got a brilliant idea, they'll be able, not dependent on a political appropriation the next year, not dependent on an economy's status the next year, but they'll know there is enough money set aside to move that brilliant idea down to preclinical work, to phase one human trials, for phase two efficacy trials, where then the private sector will pick it up and take it to patients. So I see a very bright future based upon a new model, a paradigm shift in funding that California is leading the world with.
Nancy Fun, Bob talks about funding, and certainly you're in an area as a venture capitalist and specializing in clean tech. Are we going to find the answers as well in innovation in your area? How are we going to stay competitive?
Well, it's a combination. Innovation is allowing us to transition from the traditional fossil fuel-based economy to one that is lower carbon and achieve some of the climate change goals that we all know are so important. But it is important to recognize that policy has played a role in making that happen. And the good news is that while governments are broke or struggling in many places across the country, the investments and the decisions that have been made over the several decades in California are really at the basis of the opportunity for clean tech. California decades ago enacted energy-efficient standards that then the nation adopted, the renewable portfolio standards that require utilities to sell energy from renewable sources at certain percentages, AB 32, the climate change initiative, decoupling of generation and delivery of electricity. These are all policies that California has played a lead in developing and have created the economic incentives for a viable and a thriving clean tech industry. And the good news is that unlike Las Vegas, what goes on in California rarely stays in California. and many of these policies are now adopted in other states and even at the federal government level. And so the stimulus program has carried on some of the renewables and solar and wind. We had loans to companies like Tesla in the state that allow electric vehicles to compete and develop a presence for example, the plant in Fremont, the NUMMI plant that had been shuttered. This is a metaphor for what we can all accomplish if we combine the policy and get it right, and then, as Bob said, tap into that innovation, the entrepreneurial audacity that just assumes you can develop new industries like electric vehicles, like solar, in times that are difficult financially. And I would just say that what we're seeing now that is so encouraging in the venture capital industry is that we're able to tap into some of the federal and state programs that help us get through this economy and create loans and loan guarantees to allow these companies to thrive. But we're also we're able to attract talent and take the people that have been in technology and even life sciences and get them into clean tech, because what we have is that aspirational advantage. People want to clean up the mess that we're in. They want to make a difference. Of course, they want to do well financially and create, you know, the next Google in clean tech. But we are really seeing that people are looking at clean tech as a career opportunity that, that meets a variety of needs. And so we're very bullish on the ability to create thousands and thousands of jobs in this state. I mean, a Tesla will employ 3,000 people over the next few years. A Bright Source Energy that's going to build large-scale solar plants in the desert, well, you know, 1,000 people needed to build those kinds of plants. So this is meaningful economic medicine for what's ailing us.
And to finish up our first question here, I leave it to our economic futurist, Paul Saffo. Where are the answers? And did you like any of these answers?
Well, I thought the panel did a fine job, and we can retire and have a glass of wine now. As I look at it, we have a great economy. I don't mean an economy in great shape, but great in the sense that it is large, it is diverse, it is integrated. It's in danger of being destroyed by governmental gridlock that shows no signs of easing. I love what Robert's doing. I am fundamentally a pessimist about what's happening in Sacramento. And I'm a pessimist because that governmental gridlock we have is exactly what the California public wanted. They spent decades building it. They're very attached to it. They have no intention of changing it. And underlying that public making the decisions they've made is a deep cultural malaise in this state. I think we are actually suffering through a serious cultural crisis in California. And we can and will talk about the mechanics of solving things, but unless we solve that problem, nothing else will be possible. To put it quite simply, we need new myths. You know, California is a place built on myth. The name of this state comes from a cheesy novel published in the early 1500s, the Sergas de Esplandian, that inspired a bunch of explorers who gave this place its name.
Queen.
And it was followed by one wave of myth makers and myth takers after another. After the Spanish period, we had the myth of the gold rush. You know, like Silicon Valley, most people lost their money. A few made it. Then we had the myth, the early 1900s, Hiram Johnson, the progressives, and that myth which carried us through the 20s and 30s. In the 1960s, we had two strangely intertwined myths, Pat Brown's era and building the great infrastructure of California with this vast cultural revolution, the counterculture. And then in the 80s, we had the myth of the technology revolution and the modern phase of innovation. The problem is we need new myths because the old myths we've come to rely on that once united us are now dividing us. And if we don't come up with some new myths, we are sunk.
So, Paul, I'm going to throw it back at you. What will be next? What must we do?
Give us a myth.
Yeah, give us a myth.
Have I got a myth for you, Dolly?
We need a myth.
All right, you're next, Robert.
I've been accused of spreading myth information in the past. But I actually do think it, if where the myth will come out of is an identification at a much more local level. I think that if we're going to find a new identity as a state, it's going to come out of regional identifications that are positive ones. For example, a negative one that's happened is it used to be California. You know, those of us in the New York North made fun of the South, and it was a North-South divide. And the North was liberal, and the South was conservative. That's rotated 90 degrees. If you live inside of the ocean, you are probably liberal, and you probably pay more taxes than you receive in services. If you live outside of sight of the ocean, you are conservative, and you get more from the state than you pay in taxes, and you're generally crabbier about the whole thing. We need to break those two myths up and find some common ground.
Robert Hertzberg.
Yeah, you know, Paul, it's exactly. I just saw that you'd written in the Chronicle the story of taking the Bay Area and making it a city state, and certainly, as Dr. Tyson will tell you, there's a great host of challenges with respect to that. But I think you're onto something. You know, at California Forward, I don't know if Lenny's in the room. He's one of our new board members. There he is, right here, Lenny Mendonca. We've talked about the notion of of devolving power. And here's the problem with this Sacramento thing, that 75% of the services that are provided to folks are actually provided at the local level, but they're paid for out of the state. And so when it's far off, it's waste, fraud, and abuse. For whatever it is, that's kind of how the people see it. And that's the reason why people won't support any level of tax increase. But even in Orange County, all you've got to go look at their roads of how much money the folks that are generally perceived in that county, a Republican, generally Republican county, they're raising their taxes all day long to pay for roads and other services. There's a huge issue of equity and fairness and what that looks like. But I do think both for two purposes, or three purposes, really. One, how you're really going to fund government and its interrelationship in providing services and what that looks like. Two, really making democracy legitimate. One of the great problems we've had, and I alluded to in the beginning about how the founding fathers were Protestant white men who owned land and they got the right to vote and nobody else did. You now have this wonderfully diverse place where everybody thinks they have power because they have titles at local government, but have no power because it's all in three people in Sacramento, by the way, none of whom are elected, just so you know. I'll tell you secretly who that is one of these days, but it's not the electeds who have the power. And so it really creates a gridlock. And the third thing is in globalization, speed to market, to which I earlier referred, you've got to create competition between Fresno and San Francisco and San Diego and Alta, California, and all other parts of the state where companies like BYD or Tesla or others can come in and really create and compete globally. And for those reasons, I think you're really onto something, because California, if you turn it inside, is three time zones, right? If you put it on the East Coast, it goes from the top of Florida to Connecticut. How big is that? And how many governors and senators and elected officials? It's just scale. It's just too big to work well.
Can I raise the Dr. question Tyson? That I had with this, because I'm sympathetic to it, but I think I have two reactions. One is the U.S. has the greatest degree of polarization or income diversity among the advanced industrial countries. One of the problems, when we think about the unemployment problem in the United States, it's really important to point out that the unemployment problem is significantly a problem of high school and less than high school educated workers. If you go to the unemployment rate of people with a college education, it's around 6%. It's not around 10%. And if you look at the structure of jobs in the United States over a very long period of time, you see jobs in the middle disappearing, people falling to the bottom or moving to the top. And the movement to the top is education-driven and sector-driven. So the sectors we're talking about here, which will use a fair amount of technical talent, are probably ones where the education drive is going to create jobs. If you move to a highly local way of funding, I think you run the risk of creating one of the problems that the United States has, which is we have, if you look at high school performance rates and college completion rates, and you look at where these students started, you will see major differences based on the income of the community in which the child was raised. So the more we depend, we have a great deal of income stratification in the country. The more you depend upon a tax base which reflects the local income level, the more you may actually exacerbate this stratification. I really worry about that a lot. We've seen it in education already. The second point, and I look to Lenny with this, we tend to think about the U.S. economy a lot in terms of small business, and small business is very important, but so are very large multinational companies. And they can be wherever they want to be. They can be wherever they want to be, and increasingly they are making choices not to be in a location. Now, when they choose where to be, the national policy environment matters a lot. Okay, you can't get around what the federal tax structure is in terms of how a U.S. multinational decides how much they're going to locate in California versus China or India or Vietnam, for that matter. The same thing with broad national regulatory issues. So one of the things that I've been working on with Lenny, there's a nice new study of U.S. multinationals that McKinsey Global Institute did, and you can go and listen to their concerns. And what they're saying is the national policy environment is leading them to move more of their activities abroad. They're not even mentioning, in most cases, the local environment. So we have to be very careful if we're going to work on the local environment in California, not to lose sight of the fact that there's this bigger national environment that matters a lot.
I would just say that when Tesla was deciding where to build its plant, it had offers from all over the world. People obviously wanted that. And it chose California for a lot of reasons. One of them, because when you innovate and you're developing a manufacturing profile, you want to be close to your headquarters. You want to have that interaction between your engineers and the manufacturing personnel. And so even though California has all these problems, California won. And California, the innovation, you know, YouTube, Google, Apple. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a lot of resources here that aren't going to leave the state, and what we need to do is work on the cross-fertilization and the education infrastructure to keep that innovation engine going. I think that one of the things that offers hope is that in the alternative energy sector, you're drawing on not only the environmental disciplines, but you're getting people that want to bring their expertise from Google, from the tech sector, and from the energy sector. You've got utilities that are and oil companies like Chevron. You've got Bechtel, big environmental contractors that are embracing the opportunity for renewables or for electric vehicles. And you don't get that mix in Peoria. I mean, you don't get it everywhere. You get it in places where you have this diversity of talent and the entrepreneurial
zeal. Just shut your radio broadcast off in Peoria, I used to.
Sorry, Peoria.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we are discussing how to keep California and the nation economically competitive. Our panelists are Dr. Laura Tyson, economist, member of President Obama's Economic Recovery Advisory Board, and professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Paul Saffo, economic futurist, managing director of Discern Analytics, and visiting scholar at the Stanford MediaX Research Network. Nancy Fun, venture capitalist and managing partner at DBL Investors. Robert Hertzberg, former speaker of the California State Assembly, partner at Mayer Brown LLP, and environmental entrepreneur. And Bob Klein, chairman of the governing board of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. I'm Sydney Kohara of CBS 5 Television in San Francisco. We continue now with our discussion. And Robert Klein, Bob Klein, you had a comment.
So, picking up on Dr. Tyson's point, I think it's critical that California strategically identify its advantages in the international market, and certainly one of those is in the biomedical field. California has 50% of all the biomedical research capacity in the United States, and considered as a nation, it has more capacity than any other nation in the world. If we look back historically, we see that in 1977, there was only 17,000 biomedical jobs in California, and there was another controversial new medical area of potential breakthrough called recombinant DNA, which the opposition said would never lead to any human benefit. Fortunately, the federal government didn't stop this area of research because in 1978 they created artificial human insulin that keeps my youngest son alive every day. And in the next decade, it led to 100 critical heart and cancer drugs and then led us into the knowledge to help us decode the human genome. This led to 2005 with 277,000 jobs in biomedical research. We're building off of a massive concentration of human resources here. And with the long-term financing that Proposition 71 brought for stem cell research, we are pulling in stem cell research companies and biotech research companies generally into California because they understand there's a policy supporting what is an area of strategic advantage. And certainly, it is very important that we realize what Dr. Tyson said about the stratification of jobs and incomes in the state and the distortions in the job market. So as a model, not at scale, but as a model at a low scale, we have a program called the Bridges Program that connects 38 junior colleges, city colleges, and state colleges with the top universities and research centers in the state, like the Salk Institute, like the Burnham Institute, and Scripps. where students from city colleges can pair up with the best research labs in the world, learn the technical skills, and perhaps be inspired to go on to a master's degree or higher, so that we have a vertical penetration of our educational opportunity in this state and build the opportunity in the strategic sector at all levels. So I think that we have strategic opportunities, we can identify our strengths and build vertically with good models and innovate where we can locally and statewide build examples of where the future is for California and this country.
Paul Saffo.
You know, running under what Bob and Nancy and Laura were all talking about, and Laura was pretty explicit about, is education. And I think that's a good case study for understanding our problem. Mm-hmm. When the Berlin Wall fell and the evil empire turned into a trading neighbor, the world was transformed from a world defined by an arms race to a new kind of race. The arms race has been replaced by the brain race. And California started unilaterally disarming in 1978 with the passage of Proposition 13. We crippled our schools.
Thank you.
And not satisfied with that, we proceeded as a state to now cripple our great universities. You know, UC is sliding in the international listings. And you know, my favorite fact is, you know, since 1982, we've built 23 prisons. We have built 3 university campuses in the state. And we, of course, pay more per year to take care of our prisoners, about $52,000 a year, than my university, Stanford, charges students coming in. So it's a problem that's been decades in the making, and we need to get at a fundamental root cause of that and change the dynamic, or otherwise we're just going to keep sliding while we keep coming up with new ideas.
And that is one of our questions from the audience. We talk about how big a problem Prop 13 is for the future. So, panel, what can we do about it?
Easy. We have too much democracy in California. We have way too much democracy. And our legislators, not the ones in Sacramento, but the amateur legislators, the average voting public, is the problem. They have no attention span. You know, things like Prop 140, term limits, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Robert, that was passed to get Willie Brown out of Sacramento. And a gullible California public went along. You know, so we need to get the citizens out of the fine-grained control. We have too much democracy. We need to restructure that.
Nancy?
I think certainly we have major problems in education in California. There are some bright spots. I mean, the community college system that Bob Klein described is also working quite functionally in training solar installers and energy efficiency workers that can, and these are jobs that are accessible to people that, you know, don't have the advanced degrees, and yet they're very livable wages. Many times you work for a company, after you go through the training, you can get stock options for as additional compensation. So community colleges are playing a fundamental role, and we need to protect that, because the thing about energy is that much of it is regional, much of it is local, and so if we can get that to work in California, we have a very large regional market to offer job creation. We also have, while we haven't funded energy anywhere near to the extent that it needs, and certainly relating to healthcare, it's about a 30-to-1 differential, even though it's about the same GDP relating to healthcare and energy. We have some examples in our state. We have the UC Davis Center for Energy Efficiency. We have a Stanford program, or Precourt Center for Energy Efficiency. We've never had those even 4 years ago. We never had centers of excellence in universities that focused on alternative or energy efficiency like that, and yet that's really where a lot of our the jobs and the ability to reduce climate change is happening. So there are, you know, they're chronically underfunded, but they do exist. And lastly, I would say that we're getting leadership from unlikely sources. The California Public Utilities Commission, for example, is spending $100 million to develop workforce training, including K-12 programs, to educate people about how to develop a career in energy efficiency, cooling, lighting, architecture, green buildings. Those are the jobs of the future, and certainly we need more than $100 million, but it's a good place to start.
Paul, you want to jump in?
But Nancy, I mean, it's an optimistic statement, but while our community colleges are training people to install solar panels, China is about to kill Silicon Valley in the solar industry because the Chinese government is doing vastly more to help their nascent solar industry with subsidies in land and manufacturing resources. You and I both know the solar industry in California is just going to end up being acquired by Chinese companies.
That's not true. That is absolutely not true.
Prediction. We'll see.
We're not China. The government, the stimulus program has provided $1.4 billion to BrightSource Energy in a loan guarantee to create one of the largest large-scale solar plants in the Mojave Desert and other places in the West. $400 million to Tesla Motors, $400 million to Solyndra. The government is shifting its allocation to some of these sectors. We can't do it at the price tag that China can, but we are making a difference, and we're reaching grid parity. Solar is going to be affordable, many experts say, in terms of comparing to existing approaches to electricity, in 2013. When that happens, adoption is going to accelerate, and we're going to be able to compete on a much more vibrant basis. So certainly China has advantages, but the thing about solar energy is that it has that local dimension, and we have some of in the West, the Southwest especially, we have some of the highest quality sunlight in the world, and we're finally about to make use of it.
Our optimist. I know we have a couple other on this panel as well. Let's change it up a bit. One of the questions, talking about the lessons of California that we can both teach and learn from the rest of the United States. What can we teach others? What can we learn from the rest of the U.S.? Robert, I see you moving over.
I don't know. I'm still trying to absorb the notion of eliminating the initiative process that Bob was talking about. I'll tell you. I mean, I live in the world where the democracy, however informed or ill-informed it may be at any point in time, is the power. People have the power. And you can't ignore that. I mean, I think the great lessons – I mean, the thing – I guess marrying both, being involved, so to speak, in the belly of the beast of dealing with the most ugly stuff and trying to make sausage in government and making laws and dealing with budgets on the one hand and still traveling all corners of the globe and seeing this – Bob talked about the idea of the myth. I mean, there really is – I don't know if it's so much a myth, but it does inform people who are self-selecting, who want to be here. We talk about immigration as something generally south of the border, but it's people from Denpasar and people from all parts of Africa and all parts of the world that want to come here and be part of this dream. It is a difficult place in the sense that costs are higher. Costs are higher because you can go to Cincinnati and buy a house for $25,000. It would cost $750,000. No, $1.5 million in Santa Monica because of supply and demand. And so how do you create a place that has this attractiveness by virtue of our natural beauty that Queen Calafia talked about or was in the exploits of Esplandian that Bob referred to in 1540 and still informs this place? The challenges, as I referred to earlier, are just so unique in California about how to create a government that matches the innovation and creativity of who we are. I was in London some time ago and physically got out of a taxi cab and bumped into Seth Hammett. Seth Hammett's the Speaker of the House of Alabama. And I'm going, how the heck do the people of Alabama allow you to come here without skewering you in the paper like they skewered Fabian Nunez and others for traveling the world? And they go, are you kidding? They celebrate that I go because I bring back Mercedes and Toyota and all these other places. Well, those aren't companies that would naturally locate here in California. California. It is the Tesla Motors that want the innovation as opposed to what our policies are and what our values are. So it's really trying to recalibrate the government, to reinvent the government in a way to match what this myth, this story about California, which I still think is informed by the island of California that Queen Calafia talked about in that Exploits of Esplandian. And I do think it's what motivated, if we talk to all the grandparents and parents who came here, first generation, around the folks in this room and are listening, are informed. And that's the challenge that we face. And it's a challenge, but it's a great challenge because everybody still wants to come to California. The bottom line is when we see these stories on the front page of The Economists and China Daily about California falling in the ocean, not because of an earthquake, but because government can't get out of its way, that to me is the biggest threat that we face.
I have a couple. I'll give you a positive and a negative way that California gives lessons. One is actually the value of great research universities and the clusters that form around them. It is no accident that we have 50% of the biomedical capability of the country. We developed great universities that were funded significantly, dramatically, by federal funding from National Institutes of Health and other places that provided the foundation for this research and for the skilled scientists who come out of those universities, create businesses. I think that's a lesson. The importance of the cluster is also that there's a venture capital community around it. So you actually have the knowledge supported first and foremost by the federal government as a source of basic research support, creating products that diffuse through companies with the help of venture capital. Those are very important lessons around the world. And believe me, every country around the world is trying to copy California in that regard, and many, many states in the United States have tried, and some of them have succeeded in copying California. Related to that is immigration, and in particular, skilled immigration. Because these great research universities in California, as most people here know, you will see a significant, in many disciplines, more than half of the master's and PhD students are foreign students. And they come from emerging market countries and from Europe and from, and we don't, and we make it difficult for them to stay. And I have said we should have a policy where if you get an advanced degree here, you get a green card. You basically have a right to stay and have a job. That's what we want you to do. Those are lessons from. Now I'm going to give you my negative lesson on California because I'm closer to Paul here than to Bob. And I think the mayor of New York has made this point, Mayor Bloomberg, so a Republican, not a Democrat. And it's basically that what we learn from California, Paul Krugman has also made this point, a Democrat, that what we learn from California is that citizens like to vote for things they would, services they would like to receive, and they would like to vote against revenues to pay for them.
Yeah.
Okay? That doesn't
work. That is
work.
The bottom line.
That doesn't work long term.
And you.
Well, let me say that the thing that worries me the most now, I think we all agree at this table that investment in education is important, investment in research is important, the government has a role to play. The American public in the latest polls is fed up with the stimulus. They're fed up with the deficit. They want to cut. I can assure you in the political process, these are going to be the easy marks to cut because things like Social Security and health care are the hard marks to cut. And revenue raisers are even harder. So think about it. Part of what this panel has to do is really, and the rest of us who believe this, is educate the voter to understand that certain kinds of government spending are investments in our future. And if we cut those because of a concern about the deficit, which is understandable, we will end up in the future having unilaterally disarmed in research as well as education.
Robert?
So taking off of Laura Tyson's point, I think it's critical that we look at how we're funding this research and what we're asking the voters to do, how we're funding the intellectual capital generally in this state, whether it's in alternative energy or whether it's in stem cell research. Proposition 71 has a fundamental concept that you spread the burden of the intellectual capital you're funding up front over the generations that'll benefit from those discoveries. If you look at the 1950s, the polio epidemic was widespread, and they thought that by 2005 it had cost $100 billion a year just to put victims in hotels of polio. That cost was avoided because there was an investment in intellectual capital in late 1950s. And we are investing in intellectual capital to cure chronic disease. That cost should be spread over the 40 or 50 years through long-term bonds. The voters have to be able to distinguish between deficit funding bonds, which are not good for this economy or any economy, and bonds that invest in capital. And it's not physical capital anymore. That drove the last century with bridges and harbors. It's the intellectual capital that has to be funded, and those benefits in alternative energy, in biomedical research, need to be paid for over a long period of time. And voters, when they approve them, and we had the backing of every chamber of commerce in California, from San Diego to San Francisco, including the Orange County Business Council, including the state chamber, they have to come to the table to pay the taxes, to pay the bonds. So it is very important that we look at what we need to fund for the intellectual capital to drive the century in California and make the connection for the voters to responsibly back legislators to pay for it.
I wanted to continue the conversation about education because a good many of the questions that we're getting are about the education system, one calling it the failing California educational system, which is not creating graduates competent in needed technologies. How do you fix it? How do you get 25 million people without college degrees in the knowledge-based economy to be educated and part of our manufacturing so it's not going somewhere else?
Can I?
Robert Hertzberg.
Thank you. Yeah, Paul would talked about, I wrote down the words, I'm trying to look where he said this, but this whole bankruptcy notion, I think you got to divide it up into certain sectors, and it was referred to in various parts of this conversation. The first is the University of California and really the research arm of that. And really going with the notion what Bob was talking about, a dedicated revenue stream, we have to figure out how to disconnect the volatility of what's happening in the state and in revenue streams in government with the university, because University of California is getting poached by, no disrespect to Leland Stanford Junior University and University of Southern California and Princeton and a lot and Harvard and other places with these great minds who are frustrated about this not having this. And there's ways to do this where we can be innovative and really create dedicated revenue streams to pay for the university system. Two, the community college system we have in California, one of the things the voters have done that's just really been brilliant is we have passed these bonds to pay for new school construction and the like, $70 billion statewide and locally, and at most recently 50% of those revenues, of the higher education revenues, going to community colleges, which we call it, we've been calling in Sacramento, the classrooms of the new economy, because folks don't go to school anymore and have and get the gold, go to have a job and get the gold watch. They come back and get retrained and retrained, whether it's nursing or solar installations or what the world's going to look like in renewables in 20 years from now. They're hugely important deliverables in terms of the society working. And then the other element is really the K through 12 piece. And, you know, I grapple with that in terms of the whole local piece. And I stop with this because I think that one of the great honest challenges is the disconnect between the folks that are paying the bulk of the taxes and the kids that are coming into the schools. And I just think that the way we fix the problem is to make schools parts of communities, that you get your library services and your social services and your park at the school so that there's a unity of interest between the community and the school site instead of having a school site chained up at 3 o'clock and it's only a threat to the community and those kids are making noise and who are those kids and they don't look like me and all that stuff versus there being a merging, if you will, of the interests of a community, of everybody in that community and the school sites. And I think that's one of the great mistakes that we've made is to decouple schools from community, and hence it's been easy to just throw them under the bus, so to speak, instead of properly fund them.
That's a good one.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today, we are discussing how to keep California and the nation economically competitive. Our panelists are Dr. Laura Tyson, economist, member of President Obama's Economic Recovery Advisory Board, and professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Paul Saffo, economic futurist, managing director of Discern Analytics, and visiting scholar at the Stanford MediaX Research Network. Nancy Fun, venture capitalist and managing partner at DBL Investors. Robert Hertzberg, former speaker of the California State Assembly, partner at Mayor Brown LLP, and environmental entrepreneur. And Bob Klein, chairman of the governing board of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. I'm Sydney Kohara of CBS 5 Television in San Francisco. We continue now with our discussion. Education fixes. Paul Saffo?
Well, boy, Bob, I wish I was as optimistic as you. You know, California voters made the commitment with a proposition to fund the largest educational institution in California. That was Prop 184, the three strikes law. That, you know, the prison system is our educational system that's got the most money. It accounts for 11% of the general fund of the state. UC and the state system get 7%, and it's getting slashed even further. This is a case where the California public has gotten what it wanted. And, you know, I mean, I hope something will change here, but I honestly, when I look at the deficits ahead, I think we're in for a disastrous series of years, probably about half a decade, where the educational system will get cut, where there will be, you know, serious wreckage.
And hey, Paul, can't we make you a historian instead of a futurist?
It sounds grim, but is
this
there?
Is not
what's
good.
The option? I mean,
Bob, you know this. It's a question for you. Is but if things get bad enough, will that cause people to wake up, or will it just make it?
And
worse?
Does it have to get bad enough? Do we have to wait that long?
No.
I'm just going to add, not being a futurist, but sitting next to one who's been a very good historian, I think we should also understand here, again, I started with the biggest crisis, economic financial crisis in our lifetimes. We know from history this is going to be tough going. I just wanted to say there is no easy out here. And, you know, that means years of slow growth and significant unemployment, not just in the state of California, but at the national level. The danger is exactly what everybody here in different ways is talking about. In this process of dealing with that adversity, is there a way to come up with innovative bond measures or financing measures to try to protect and build that, those things which, when we recover, will make us really soar again? And I think that's really important. And it would be great during this period of adversity if we had some cultural miss which helped us really deal with this, because it is a real challenge to everyone.
You know,
Nancy Fun?
There's a good example actually coming up in the fall in the initiative system, which we all dislike, but the whole water bond issue is one where if that passes, there's a 20% conservation mandate. Did he?
Yeah.
So it's not happening? Well, there
probably
again.
Probably 2012.
Well, when it happens, that will create a way for water to be priced more rationally. And the reason you don't see big water innovations and companies forming around water is because it's so cheap, and it's not there's no incentive really to create water saving technologies or to develop that as an industry like there is, for example, in electricity because of the RPS standards and such. So when you policy can make a difference, and if we could get a rational water policy that priced water so that we conserved it and developed technologies to make it more accessible, that would create a whole nother part of the venture capital clean tech chain, and therefore develop companies that would pay taxes and contribute to the revenues of the state.
So. Robert Hertzberg is jumping up and down in his seat.
So what's new about that? You know, Rahm Emanuel, I guess his great quote is, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And I do think that there's a sense of crisis and a sense that Rome is burning to some extent. Lenny Mendonca, I mentioned earlier, who's on our board now at California Forward, started with this effort to have a constitutional convention, and I think legitimately tapped into an extraordinary frustration of folks that the system is so fundamentally broken. Maybe we should just start over. California Forward was more of an incrementalist approach and identified, using experts, what we thought those things were, because we were afraid, quite frankly, that it may have gone crazy. I don't know, maybe Lenny is right. We shall see. It's never over in terms of the revolution. But fundamentally, there is an issue here that I think the crisis has created in terms of California. And that is Democrats, and this goes to the issue that Paul was talking about, a devolution of power, bringing government closer to the people. I do think what Dr. Tyson talks about is correct. There's some great challenges with respect to that and great risks. But I do think fundamentally it's where we need to go to be able to compete and make the democracy legitimate. Democrats, I think are persuaded, rightly or wrongly, that Republicans will not now vote for taxes. When you look at the polling at a statewide level, only a small percentage, less than 20% of the people, will support tax increases in the state because they feel, I think, that it's waste, fraud, and abuse because it's too far away and too distant. They will, 54%. Support the pay for services where they can touch and feel and see them. The school bonds that we dealt with, the money for stem cell research, those were successful in the eyes of the political pundits and they in drafting those because they were very clear about checks and balances that people's money wasn't going to be wasted, that there were clear deliverables for the public's money. And you get that at the local level. And so what now is happening, and the reason why you're seeing, and we're talking about this at California Forward, this whole devolution piece that Paul talked about in the paper the other day for city-states, and I think he's onto something, is that because Democrats see a willingness to pay for social services if people can touch it and feel it and see it in their communities. So they want to go local and to do that where they can persuade people because they realize at the state level that's not working. And I do think this whole notion in globalizing economy of speed to market and really reinventing the new myth is where we – I think you're correct, Paul, where we do have to go. But I do think the devolution piece is where we're going to find a great deal of that solution. Difficulty, but solution.
Bob?
Yeah. And when we look at results, I think each of these experiments that yield strong results will build on itself and the confidence of the public to invest in the future. It's my hope that in the next 4 years that an international peer review group that said we have 14 different disease teams that they believe have convincing preliminary evidence of efficacy for new stem cell therapies to cure or substantially mitigate diseases from diabetes to cancer to AIDS, that a significant number of those will make it to human trials in 48 months. We just finished a phase one human trial to a young woman scientist in Southern California. A phase one trial, but 50% efficacy for polycythemia vera. It's a disease that's a type of leukemia. It's essentially a five-year death sentence where people's lives are being saved. Individuals are being taken off a bone marrow transplant list. When the public sees the results, and every one of these experiments has to be held accountable, I believe that the investment of the public, the public will invest in the intellectual capital to drive this state in the future. It's going to take some of these experiments. We're not going to succeed in all of them. We are doing a broad portfolio. I strongly believe from the evidence that I see to date that we're going to succeed and it's a significant part of our portfolio. And other models like this will have to be proven to the California public. We have to earn, essentially, the faith of the public to make the investments necessary to lift this state just like they invested in the UC system. But in order for us to get there, they're going to have to continue to support the UC system and the backbone, the infrastructure that is critical to the successes of the future.
Paul, one quick question.
One piece of practical advice. You can all do this when you go home. Do it this weekend. We need to make civics cool. We need to be a little more French. We need to make politics and civics something that is discussed intelligently in polite society. So call up a couple of your friends, invite them over to dinner, and tell them you're going to talk about the California economy, about California politics, but in a different way than people have become accustomed to doing it. If we could all take that small step and start making civics cool, then we might be on a path towards making the California populace understand what all the brilliant ideas are that my colleagues on this panel have offered.
We have two more minutes, and I think that's a good place to talk about the last question, as Paul mentioned, a sort of call to action. And I would ask our remaining panelists, what would be your call to action to the public, to the government? Dr. Tyson?
I would take it as an extension of what Paul said, because I made the point that all of us need to talk with our colleagues and our citizens about the difference between spending a dollar for something now and investing in our future. And I do think that we do run a risk right now, because everyone is looking for a way. Look, there's a lack of trust in government, absolutely. There's a concern about the deficit. What can this possibly mean? There's a kind of, therefore, we just have to scale back everything we possibly can as massively as we can. And we have to make sure that people understand the value of what we've been talking about here today, the value of education, the value of research, the value of innovation. And I will just end here. If you think about where the U.S. is really great, if you go back in the history of where the U.S. is really great in technology, whether it's biotechnology or the Internet, broadly defined information technology, you will see dramatic amounts of government support. And we used to do it for health. There's an obvious mission. We all share a desire to achieve good health for ourselves and our families. So it's in that sense, there's a challenge. We used to fund so much of our technology budget on security. And we had some things that fell into the private sector and became the source of the Internet and everything it spawned. We need to make sure we have that. And actually, it's very disturbing to hear about the water bond in the sense that there's an example. If the government can create demand for something, it can create the market for something by saying we need a water strategy. We need clean energy. Why do we have to wait to get people to move towards efficiency slowly? We can encourage them by an incentive structure which gets them to move quickly. But that requires government funding. It requires government policy. And right now people are saying government's the problem. We have to cut it. We have to cut its spending. So I would like us to make that distinction. Investment, what the government can do to help the private sector, needs to be preserved as we deal with this period of economic adversity.
Bob Klein, your final comments?
I would say mobilize these city-states in California. We have $1 billion that's flowed from donor and institutional funding that's really been mobilized by these city-states, each competing with each other. Join government and philanthropists behind the stem cell revolution. I mean, there is a phenomenal opportunity through these powerful local governments joining with philanthropists to drive centers of innovation, whether they be in Sacramento with alternative energy at UC Davis, whether they be at UC San Francisco and Stanford in a consortium for stem cell research. $1 billion of donor money in the last 3 years, that's a tough time to put money up. Mobilize those city-states and those partnerships between philanthropists and ordinary citizens and government locally to drive these initiatives that will determine the future of your city, the state, and create models for the nation.
Nancy Fund.
Well, I would say that we can't mess up what we've just started over the past few years in terms of policy directed to sustainability, to a lower carbon economy. Things like AB 32, the world is watching. If we don't enforce that, if we don't continue with that, that sends a very negative signal. And it's not just the sustainability goals, the climate change goals that are at risk. It's job creation. The companies that we've been talking about that are getting venture funding, that are getting stimulus funds, that are created out of policies like renewable portfolio standards, that's where the jobs of the future will be, and that if we cut back now, when we're just beginning to see the fruits of the policy effort and the investment translate into job creation and wealth creation, then that's going to be a tremendous setback. So I think we need to continue the policies that we've developed over the past decade or so and enhance them. And the good news is that in a few years, we'll be able to transition away from some of these incentives because technology and innovation will make them more affordable across the board.
And Robert Hertzberg.
Each generation in a democracy has the responsibility to reinvent itself. Are they going to be the greatest or the next greatest generation? Who knows? There is an issue about whether civics is cool. I think that Paul was talking about at California Forward. What we're doing is we're engaging in the biggest civic outreach program in the history of California, spending millions of dollars of the foundation money they gave to us to try to really engage folks in the most creative ways, using Twitter and Facebook and any other creative ways to tap into that dynamic that President Obama was able to tap into when he ran for President of the United States. Will we be successful? We don't know. We're trying to experiment to figure it out, to find out what those touchstones are that figures it out. I suspect most of the folks in this room are okay and they're going to retire and have enough money to live or go someplace else to do what they want. It's the next generation we don't want to screw it up for, and to offer them some hope and to use whatever wisdom and judgment that we have to pass it on. And I think part of that is to use those tools and figure out how to get them engaged. That's the biggest challenge, and because it's going to be their responsibility, and so we're putting a huge effort to try to make that happen.
I want to say thank you to our panelists. Dr. Laura Tyson, economist, member of President Obama's Economic Recovery Advisory Board and professor at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Paul Saffo, economic futurist, managing director of Discern Analytics and visiting scholar at the Stanford MediaX Research Network. Nancy Fund, venture capitalist and managing partner at DBL Investors. Robert Hertzberg, former Speaker of the California State Assembly, partner at Mayer Brown LLP, and environmental entrepreneur. And Bob Klein, chairman of the governing board of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's California Innovation Series, underwritten by Chevron Corporation. I'm Sydney Kohara of CBS 5 Television in the San Francisco Bay Area, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place to be in the know, is adjourned.